into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Writer and comedian Arthur Smith burst onto the alternative comedy circuit of the 1980s as a comedy MC. Making his debut at the Edinburgh Fringe in 1977, Smith began a lifelong association with the festival, which still survives to this day. Teaming up with comedy partner Phil Nice in 1985, Smith made a short series of parody documentaries for Channel 4 television network called Arthur and Phil Go Off. In 2000, Arthur landed his own Radio 2 series, The Smith Lectures, celebrating his favourite stand-up comics before providing the voice of BBC One's Life of Grime in 2004. I caught up with a certified grumpy old man to talk festivals, stand-up and recollections on an unparalleled career in British comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Arthur Smith. So you arrived on the comedy scene right at the very beginning of the alternative revolution. How did the socio-economic and political climate help with this subtle shift in entertainment?
Well, it wasn't that subtle. It was quite a big shift. And I suppose what coincided with the arrival of alternative comedy was also the arrival of Mrs. Thatcher. And at that time, you were either, it was quite divided society in a way, as it is now a bit more. You were either for Thatcher or you hated Thatcher. And obviously, the old school comedians tended to be in the first of those two clubs. There were a lot of Tory, most of them said they were Tories. But we were resolutely of the left, and one of the things that involved was not doing racist material and material homophobic or sexist or anything. And it was quite a divided time, as I say, and this was also when stand-up comedy went from being just a succession of old jokes to being more of a discussion on the nature of the world or observation comedy. That was coming in from America a bit. So everything changed around then, I suppose. And economically, it was a very divided time too. And that was when Thatcher started attacking the unions. So, and the miners' strike was not long after. And we alternative comedians, I still feel the need for inverted commas, we were on the side of the miners, and I did benefits for the miners, and then when the Falklands War came, it was you weren't allowed, unless you were down at the comedy store, you couldn't really say publicly that you were against it, almost. So, yes, there was no doubt that politics impinged on the comedy of the time.
Don Ward's Comedy Store is always cited as the birthplace of alternative comedy. How important was this in giving your generation a platform to hone your craft?
Well, the Comedy Store was the first comedy club that catered to a different type of comedian. And the first time I went there, before I was doing comedy really, well I was in reviews and things, but before I'd done stand-up, and I saw Alexis Sale, and Aid Edmondson and Rick Mayall and French and Saunders, and that was the place where we all honed our skills. And it was quite a wild night sometimes. When I was comparing the Comedy Store regularly in the mid 80s, there were shows at 8 o'clock and then another one at midnight, so it didn't end till 2 a.m. 2:30 a.m. in the morning. So, and a few people had a few pints along the way, including some of the acts, including me a bit by the end. And so that was a place where you could try stuff out a bit. I mean, it became more regimented as it got more popular. But then other little clubs sprang up around London and then slowly spread off to the world. And now you can do a gig, I believe, on the moon. Dublin with the Mars ones.
Okay, so you've been observing comedy all over the world. What makes venues like the Comedy Store unique?
Well, there have been three. Well, I suppose what the Comedy Store has is that it's its history and it's where it started, the whole world of alternative comedy. It's now in, it's been in three different venues, and I've played all of them. The very first one was, was it above or below a sort of strip club or something in Meard Street. The second one was in Leicester Square, and where it is now is just over there. So it's bang, central London. It has the feel that you're at the centre of the world in some ways, or at least that's how it felt to me in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s. And I think Don's booking policy was also had an effect on obviously the kind of acts that were on and the kind of acts that and the kind of comedy that then became popular. They never really liked having jugglers or mime acts or spech acts or vent acts, ventriloquists, partly because the ceiling was too low. And that was one of the pleasures of the Comedy Store, the low ceiling. You had a real intensity about the atmosphere there. And as it still is in the new venue in Oxenden Street. But the Comedy Store, for any comedian starting out, to get a booking at the Comedy Store is really bang. That's your first big step. And everyone's really pleased about that, in a way that even when they're getting their 10th TV series 10 years later, it's not as exciting as getting your first gig at the Comedy Store.
This is a difficult question, but out of the thousands of debut comedy shows you've seen both in Edinburgh and around the world, which comics have left a lasting impact on you?
Well, a lot of comics have left a lasting impact on me. I suppose Alexis Sale, when I first saw him, was a real huge... I thought, gosh, he's talking about Muesli and unions and he had... And that had, no one had talked about Muesli before then. But I suppose Alexis Sale, Linda Smith, the great Linda Smith, who was a sublimely witty and person full of insight. I'll quote two of her jokes that I like to do sometimes. She once said, and I think this is particularly appropriate at the moment, she once said, see, the trouble with the Middle East is that somehow or other our oil has ended up under their sand. And I was thought, yeah, that's sort of what all the fighting's about, really. And she said, if God had wanted us to believe in him, he would have existed. Which always used to get a big laugh, and still does. Eddie Izzard.
Is it true you discovered him?
Well, no, but I'm happy to go along with that myth. I remember, though, when he was starting out, Eddie, he wasn't very good at all initially, and he kind of got away with it, but for ages people say, oh no, Eddie Izzard's on the bill. And then I think he had a turning point. And he did a set, I think it was on Comic Relief or something, where he just suddenly, it gushed from him and he was hilarious. And then, so I did a few gigs with him and I did book him for something once. So I discovered Eddie Izzard, who I noticed has just done he's up to his usual tricks. He's just done his 17th marathon in a row or something for World Humanity. And in 10 different countries. He's amazing, Eddie. He's an extraordinary man. I would sometimes wonder if he ever just wants a day off. Or
just to relax every now and then.
Well, I think his idea of relaxing is running a marathon.
You've done like a
You don't like the idea of running a marathon then?
No, no. I mean, I used to be a runner in when I was in my early, you know, at school. I used to run cross country for the school team, and indeed brief once for London Schoolboys. So I've done a bit of running, but frankly, I've got a bit old now in the marathon. You know, I mean, I've walked a marathon over 3 days, staying at a nice hotel for 2 nights.
Okay, so you frequently cited Richard Pryor as a contender for the greatest ever stand-up comedian. What made him so unique?
Well, all sorts of things. I suppose his attack, and his, but also the fact that he was doing the sort of material that no one had done before, that he was the first kind of radical black comedian, that he had an improvisatory wild skill, and he was a wild man as well, of course. And you know, in some ways, I like a guy who lives high on the hog, although it's unfortunate he died young. But he was, having said that, I can't really remember any Richard Pryor routines now, they've kind of escaped me. But I remember the impact he had, and all those Americans, of course, Lenny Bruce as well. These were the guys who were speaking truth with laughs in it, somehow, is how we felt. I mean, that's the way it was true, but that's how we felt about it. He was a kind of, you know, punk character in a way, because punk was also a kind of influence on the alternative comedy scene, because it was, anyone can have a go, you don't have to do these chords, you can be out of tune, you can, and there were a lot of entertaining acts that I've seen, and now the world of comedy is sort of open to everyone. I can think of two comedians actually with cerebral palsy, isn't there? There's Francesca Martinez and Rosie Jones. There's probably more, I imagine.
Yeah.
And
Lost Voice Guy.
Oh yeah, Lost Voice Guy. Yeah. I've done gigs with him. He's hilarious. Yeah, and there was another one. I interviewed someone, a woman who had Tourette's. So, and she said biscuit every other word. But she was hilarious.
Why does the Edinburgh Fringe remain such a pivotal rite of passage for upcoming comedians?
Yes, it certainly does. I think it's partly the time of year. It feels a bit. You know, it's the end of the season. Also, it is the unique thing about Edinburgh is that anybody at all can go and put on a show at the festival. Whereas all other festivals, you have to be invited, and they tend to be professional people, or, you know, even if they're not, they've been invited along. And whereas Edinburgh started out just as on the fringe of the main event, which was the International Festival, which had been put together after the war as a way of bringing Europe together. But the fringe started because someone thought, that's good. Well, maybe I'll put on some other show nearby and we'll make some money, or we'll at least. And so it has an organic beginning. It wasn't ever planned. It was never meant to be a corporate event. And there's still a huge element of that, although, of course, now it's the biggest arts festival in the world, and it's just mayhem. And Edinburgh's such a beautiful city to be in, especially in August, I would say. And that's where all the critics go, and all the, you know, there's a whole huge number of people obviously going to shows and open to shows. There's all sorts of variety of shows, and it's a chance to meet fellow comics who you might not see at other times during the year. It's like a big holiday camp in some ways, and it's a place where you can, well, it's less so in a way, but it's a place you can try out new ideas, experiment. I think the trouble is now it's becoming very, very expensive for people to go. The rent that's there are just insane. It's, you know, you have to pay $5,000 accommodation for while you're there or something. So that means that it's less easy for the acts who are starting out. Although, on the other hand, they have the there's the free festival, so you can do a show, you don't have to pay for the room or anything, and you do your own PR and whatnot, so, and then you just take a hat round at the end, and people do all right from that too. So there's still an almost infinite number of ways of doing shows. So I've done shows up on top of Arthur's Seat, and I took a bus load out to Loch Ness once. I've done some ridiculous things at the Edinburgh Fringe, but fortunately, none of them killed me. Some of them nearly did. I did get arrested once.
Okay. In 2000, you secured your own BBC Two Radio 2 show entitled The Smith Lectures, presiding over classic stand-up routines from some of Britain's greatest comedians. How difficult was it to select the clips to make up the programme, and what did it teach you about the art of live performance?
Well, it wasn't that difficult because the producer did most of the work on selecting the clips. He knew the kind of thing I liked, and he'd pick a subject for the week, and then he'd trawl through. He had a huge archive of his own, let alone the BBC one. Well, what it taught me is that that laughter's been going on for a long time, and the ways of making it happen alter sometimes and swim across other lakes, but nevertheless, funny is something that is humans need, and there were clips going back 50 years sometimes on the Smith Lectures that were still funny, or even funnier somehow, and they also conjured up a world of laughter disappearing into the sky and that you felt a connection with. Laughter is the one true metaphysical consolation, is what I think Anthea Turner said. Yeah, might not have been Anthea Turner. It might have been Nietzsche.
You don't get many shows like that anymore.
No, it's true. Like I say, you have to understand there are now over 86 million comedians in the world, or no, just in Britain alone. or at least there are a lot of comedians now, and so there's a lot of different styles, and yeah, I applaud. If you're laughing, then mostly it's fair enough. Although, as we know, there's big debates now about what is and isn't acceptable. But funny enough, when I started out, we made it unacceptable to do racism, sexism, homophobia. So it's a moving sea.
You made a what? But you made a satire of it.
Yeah. Yes. What you mean in the Smith Lectures?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I suppose I took on a rather grand role and claimed that I was the it was the University of Tooting Bec special rates for cash and I was a lecturer there. So I suppose I was undermining my own grandiosity, I hope. the idea was that, yes, I was teaching a bunch of comedy students, one of whom may have been you, Josh.
Yeah.
Okay. Just 3 years later, you presented an 8-part series celebrating 21 years of Just for Laughs Montreal Comedy Festival. How significant has this been, giving international comedians a platform for their art?
Well, I've only been to the Montreal Festival that one time. But there's no doubt that's like a condensed Edinburgh, where you've got just really the top acts, and everywhere you go there's agents and bookers, and I remember the first year, was it that year, there was people who became famous actors and comedians after us, Americans are getting their acts from all over the world. So it's a very intense couple of weeks, and by and large you'll find that most successful comedians have done a session at the Montreal Festival at one time or another. Yeah, I'd like to go back, but I don't think they'll ask me now.
Why?
Well, you have to accept as you grow older that there's a whole heap of new young comedians coming in, and they've got to be given their chance.
But my condition stopped.
Why do you think it stopped?
Why do I think what has stopped?
Your
show.
Yeah, well, who knows? There are so many reasons why these things come and go. I remember I got a bit annoyed with them because they paid me for a year once and went and complained, and maybe that had put them off, but I don't know. You're never privy to the reasons why you lose a job entirely. Sometimes it's because you're too old. I mean, it's why do you get a job in the first place? You never entirely know, but it's in the hands of other people, which is one thing that Edinburgh isn't, in a way. If you want to do your own show up there, you just do it yourself. You can produce yourself. I've never really been a very corporate kind of a guy. So, I don't always fit in and put the right tie on, shall we say.
So in 2003, you teamed up with an array of household names for the irreverent documentary series Grumpy Old Men.
Oh, yeah.
Do you like being known as a grumpy old man, and how surprised were you by the popularity of the series?
Yeah, well, I was very surprised. As far as I was concerned, it was just some interview I did one afternoon outside a pub or something, and then bang, it proved to be very popular and they flogged it. Well, I'm glad I did it because... really, I've never been that great on TV, and that was probably the thing where I was most relaxed and probably did it the best. And it's still the thing that I'm still introduced as a grumpy old man even now, which sort of is rather depressing given that was 15 years ago and I was a grumpy old man then. So God only knows what I am now. I'm an ancient old whinger.
Why do you think that you've never done that on TV?
Why do you think you've never found a platform on TV?
I've never really liked being on TV. It always felt like I was being channeled or pushed in a direction by people, and that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I've done some quite a bit of TV. I was in a double act, and we did a series called Arthur and Phil Go Off in the mid-80s that I was most pleased for. I don't think, for one thing, they want people to be really young and pretty on TV, and whilst I was briefly young, pretty never really came my way. And I've always preferred words. I've never really been a visual comedian, so I don't fall over and stand on my head. So I've always been better off on radio, I think. And hey, maybe it's not too late. Maybe I'll be in a programme. Me and you, Josh.
Yeah.
Don't give him ideas.
Yeah, we'll do a double act.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he's not that good on radio.
Yeah, but you're better than me on telly, that's for sure.
You've lent your voice to a number of documentaries, including Life of Grime, taking over from the late John Peel. How did this extend your audience?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it does extend your audience. No, it does to a certain extent. For example, because at the moment, not for doing voiceovers for adverts and things, they come and go, but, well, they've gone now for me, but but I still do the voiceover on a series called Money for Nothing, which is still being made and is going out, and I have to go to Glasgow to do it for some reason. which is about people rescuing crap off a skip and then turning it into, you know, then doing it up and flogging it off for 250 quid. And I supply the slightly laconic, shall we say, voiceover to it. And I noticed that actually it's very popular and that lots of people say, oh, I've heard you on Money for Nothing. So my voice has probably always been a better asset to me than my face.
Can you ever take me and
did you ever think back, way back when you started out, that you'd ever end up on a programme about rubbish?
No, but looking now, I realise it's a rather perfect symbol of that. A good gag, Josh. That'll be good when we do our TV
show. Okay, so having such a formidable career in comedy, why have you crossed the border into light-hearted journalism with appearances on programmes like The One Show? Do you think there's a correlation between comedy and broadcasting?
Well, The One Show, or as it's known, Blue Peter for Grown-Ups, did used to ask me on, and I only really did it because they were interesting subjects, a lot of them, that I covered, but always, you were always restricted in what you could say, and they'd always pretty much decided what the thing was, the little film was going to be, really, before you got there. And I was sort of wanted to find out a bit more, it was, and there were jokes you couldn't make and words you couldn't use. And I haven't really ever done much of that. I could probably present some travel show or something that, if it was somewhere I was actually interested in and where we could find out rather than have a script that had been written before you'd even got there. But I did a series in the 90s on Radio 4 called Sentimental Journeys. That was a great thing. I had six series of that where I went away to a place where my subject, who was someone well known for whatever reason, had a real connection with, either they grew up there or they lived there, or and that, I'd love to do one of those on the telly again, but I don't think they'd have the money now. And but that, yeah, so I went to Havana with Arthur Scargill, and I went to the south of Italy with Jermaine Greer, and oh, and probably the best one of all, I went, Miriam Margolyes and me went to Belarus. Yeah, so many people can say that.
What an experience.
Yeah, she's great fun, Miriam Margolyes. You should get her on.
So you wouldn't do the real Marigold Hotel then?
Well, nah. I don't know, I'd feel a bit cooped up by it, I think, somehow. Like they, well, I was briefly asked about it at one point. I don't know if I'm going to hang out with loads of other fucking actors. Miriam, yes, but I don't know. I'd rather create my own new shows. And, you know, I'm thinking about what I might do in Edinburgh this year. I've vaguely got an idea that I'm going to teach the audience to speak French. Parce que moi, j'arrive à parler en français, évidemment.
Yeah.
Is that it then?
I thought you were about to ask something then. No, there's two more questions.
Yeah.
Josh always finishes off with these two. So, yeah. Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Yes. Well, I guess co-writing a play that ran in the West End for 2 years and then toured everywhere. That was An Evening with Gary Lineker. That's the obvious one, though, but... perhaps I'm proudest of the moment I had an audience in front of me at the foot of Arthur's Seat, and I recited this poem and ended it with, and maybe someone's dancing on the mountains for you. And I had on top of Arthur's Seat six ballet dancers. and I cued by text, you know, and they started dancing. The audience looked up, and the scale of that joke is something I've always been proud of. And the fact that I managed to get six ballet dancers to stand up there and dance in the wind for nothing.
Finally, what's next for Arthur Smith?
I'm going to die tomorrow.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Josh, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you. You obviously have done your own work, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.